To the gods, non-gods, so forth. Listen to this teaching, subduing the horse of your senses. This teaching of the Buddha is like nectar to the ears of living beings to quell the torments of negative emotions. I pay homage to the Gautama who are compelled to rot the holy Dharma to rid us of all distorted views. So please take tea. So someone has told somebody to take bread, but he was showing his picture or something. One postcard was distributed this morning. He was showing to His Holiness this picture of Vajrasattva as if indicating that the bread was actually offered by Vajrasattva. He's just joking. So as we usually pray, may this place be filled with monastics who hold the three vows, the three precepts, and may we be able to preserve the Dharma through study and practice. So when we came into exile in the beginning, we were rather without any protector, but we actually determined to work hard. For example, in the monks who came to exile were put in a place called Misamari. And as we said, that we needed a special separate place for those who engage in philosophical studies, the students of Buddhist philosophy. And then for the general public, we thought of sending them to places which are from Misamari to other places which are cooler so that they could actually make some living. And so therefore, people were sent to Chamba and other places to build roads. So a few about 1,000 monks were there. Who were also making, building the roads in Chamba. So we had a bi-monthly confession ceremony one time when I visited them. And so the monks were actually not having their robes, but they were wearing the chupa, the layperson's dress for Tibetans. And so it was. I said maybe we should make this an exceptional case. And I told them, even though they were wearing chuba, they could actually take off the sleeve, and we did this the bi-monthly confession. And then the monks were sent to a place called Baksadwar. About 300 were accepted to sent there by the Indian government. And so, but we requested that maybe 1,500 should be sent there. And we requested the Indian government, and which was approved, and then these 1,500 monks were sent to Baksadwar, which was very remote place. And so they had no way to get distracted. But because of the place being very remote, the monks actually had food poisoning, and also many monks became sick with tuberculosis because of the the climate there, where there was not much wind or breeze blowing. And then there was some idea of moving down to the settlements. And so the elder monks and abbots were quite concerned that the monks, if they were sent to the settlements, there would be lots of distractions because of the local villagers around. So they were right in a way. But in Lhasa, nearby Lhasa, there are those great monastic institutions, and the monastic institutions were not actually distracted by the Lhasa town or city, and therefore we said perhaps it would not be so bad if the monks were moved down to the settlements down in South India. And so we moved slowly, we moved the monks to the South Indian settlements, Tibetan settlements. And initially the monks lived in huts, thatched huts. So with regard to the Buddha Dharma, it is said by the Buddha himself that he would have very little concern if the monastic had the practice of the three practices of the bimantra confession, the rainy season retreat, and the conclusion of that retreat. And the most important thing that we were thought of was the study of the Dharma, which is not just reading the Dharma, to preserve the Dharma. It's not just it's not going to be done merely through reading the scriptures, but we have this tradition of studying the text, the classic text, word by word, and also learning it through debate, dialectical debate, amongst the monks, the students. And from generation to generation, this tradition has been passed down, and we have kept it for the last over 2,000 years. This tradition was there in Tibet and also in India and also in Tibet since Shantarakshita started the tradition of Master Nalanda, the Nalanda Institution. Of course, there has been lots of ups and downs in the Dharma, but with regard to the study of logic and epistemology, of course, in China, I heard that there is the Naya Parvesha of the Door to Logic by Dignaga in Chinese translation. In the past, I heard there is this. But it seems that the seven treatises of logic and epistemology by Dhammakirti didn't exist in Chinese translation in the past. But these days, of course, there are these texts as well. And then, but then in Tibet, we have not only these root texts by Dignaga and Dhammakirti, but there are lots of commentaries by Indian masters to these texts. And Tibetans took special interest in logic and epistemology, and the indication of this is that we have, for example, Shakya Pandita writing his own text on logic and epistemology called The Treasury of Logic and Reasoning. And then there are the masters like Chabacharya Senge, who actually took great interest in the debate. And it seems the debating, dialectical debate, actually prospered in Tibet under the mastership of Chabacharya Senge and his followers. And so Tibetans have preserved and promoted, greatly preserved and promoted the logic and epistemology. So when people took interest in logic and epistemology, Of course, in the Vinaya, when we study Vinaya, there is not much usage of the dialectical debate as given in logical texts. And so Gungyen Lama Jaren Shepa was said to have said that because he was very learned in the Abhisamaya, in the perfection of wisdom studies, and somebody asked him when he went back to Amdo, somebody asked him, it seems that you have actually emphasized on the study of perfection of wisdom and not others like logic and Madhyamaka, and he said, of course, the perfection of wisdom study is main. And so he said that Madhyamaka is actually the view of the Prajnaparamita studies, and then Abhidharma is the ornament of the detailed study of the different points of perfection of wisdom, and then the logic and epistemology are the logical reasonings that for reasonings of perfection of wisdom. So he said all these other studies actually come within the study of perfection of wisdom. And so I met one scientist, very renowned scientist, who has told me that you, we Tibetans, you have this great study of Dharma through logic and epistemology, through debate. And he asked me if this system or way of learning Dharma and philosophy could be used in other subjects as well or not. And I told him, yes, it can be used. And today we have people who have written texts in which they use the logical procedures that are used in traditional subjects in the monastic institutions to study language and the grammar, and these are taught. So in Tibet, in the whole of Tibet, Ötzang and Dötö and Dome, Amdo and Kham regions, everywhere, all in all the different Tibetan Buddhist traditions, like Sakya, for example, where there has been this tradition of learning Buddhist philosophy through reasoning, and then there are in the Kagyu traditions. Nyingma tradition, studying the classic texts, the 13 classic texts. There were great masters who were also holding upholders of Vinaya in these traditions. And then in these monastic institutions of Sera Garden and Depong and so forth, and we have so many monks who actually go through the studies of these classic texts through logic and debate. And so it seems from these, when we look at this, we have actually materialized, fulfilled this prayer where which I recited in the beginning. So in the modern world, of course, there is so much advancement in education, science, and technology, but people lack the means to make transformation within the mind, and therefore people take interest in the subject of transformation of the mind. So for this, of course, we have to know the map of the mind, how the workings of the mind. Even if you don't, wish to make transformation, if you don't know how the mind works, then you would only have to resort to prayers, or in the worst case scenario, in desperate situations, you would resort to drugs, tranquilizers, or sleeping pills. And there are people who do that kind of thing. Or else people just wander around the world and distract themselves in order to forget their the disturbed state of mind. They rather find some kind of a gratification in the sightseeing and listening to music and so forth. And so, at such a time in today's world, we have this the Indian tradition where there is the tradition of the cultivation of calm abiding, shamatha and vipassana, which has to do with psychology, and especially Buddhism, which teaches in great detail about psychology. And so people, without thinking about the religion as such, just to help people calm their minds. In this world, we have this huge gap between rich and poor, and to have a moral world with full of morality, and where there is honesty and transparency amongst people, if we could reduce this extreme self-centeredness and adopt to cultivate the altruistic attitude, and to be able to see that the problems and good things that happen in life come about through causes and conditions. And so if we could see these the different experiences that we have in the world from the perspective of dependently arising or dependent origination, then we actually could have a very beneficial way of looking at things around us. And so the study that we are doing here in these monastic institutions are relevant to such world, people in this world. And so Buddhism, which we study, of course, the students, monks and students who are doing the studies of Buddhism and Buddhist philosophy in these monastic institutions have, since many years, we have also started for them the study of signs. And now the Gelugpa organization has examination board has actually decided that signs would be part of the examination for degree of Geshe Dharam. And so since 6 or 7 years, we have had many volunteer teachers from the West teaching signs to our monastics. And many of them have told me, I've met them. Of course, the monks have difficulty with language. They didn't know English in the beginning, and also mathematics they didn't know. Despite these difficulties, when the volunteer teachers taught them science and mathematics, the monks were able to actually see where there are contradictions and inconsistencies in the presentation of signs by these, and therefore the teachers were quite amazed at these the way the monks were able to actually analyze things quite rigorously. So this tradition that we have, the Buddhist tradition of logic and cosmology and the philosophy we have, is not only for us, but of course, if we could actually serve others as we do our prayers, as we say our prayer, may I be able to, may all sentient beings have happiness and so forth. And so if we could also use our knowledge to help others, it would be very good. We don't have to talk about converting people to Buddhism as such. We don't have to talk about religion as such, but even during the time of the Buddha, the whole of India could not be converted to Buddhism. And similarly, during the time of Ashoka, who ruled all over India, he couldn't do that. So we are not actually propagating Dharma, Buddhism, but what is taught in the words of the Buddha and its treatises, exegetical treatises. If If there are things in our teachings which are beneficial to others, which we could use to serve others, then we must. The 300-plus volumes of Kanjur and Tenjur, I usually make the three categories within the content of these texts. So with regard to psychology and the natural science or physics, of course, when we go into details and when we actually go into the subtle levels of these, of course, the science is much more advanced. But in our text, there is mention of the elements of the earth, water, wind, and fire. And there is this process of the evolution of things and then dissolution processes going on. So we could learn. So we could say that these subject matters, like the psychology and the physical world, physical matters could be categorized as signs, as taught in Buddhism, Buddhist signs. And then the second category is the Buddhist philosophy. Of course, there are some things which may not be so relevant in science, but then the theory of dependent origination is something which is very relevant, which is very beneficial, even scientists say. So when you are able to see that things come in dependence on many different causes and conditions, many different factors, then you have a very broad view of things. You can see things and events in in a holistic manner. So we can actually consider this Buddhist science and Buddhist philosophy as something which as academic studies, subjects for academic studies. So Buddhist religion, of course, cannot be taken as universal subject. But the Buddhist science and Buddhist philosophy are universal. So I even tell my friends, like Muslims, that of course you have your own religious faith, but with regard to dependent origination, if you could study this idea or the theory of dependent origination, it is something which is relevant to the world environment, environmental issue, as well as any other international relations and so forth. They are relevant. So when it comes to serving the, when certain issues that are related to the whole world and not some kind of a, some parts of the world partially, if we could understand the dependent origination well, then it's very going to be very helpful. And even in the case of health and hygiene, even scientists today say that for physical health, mental health is very important. So if you are relaxed and calm, you have good health, whereas if you are full of anxiety, anger, jealousy, pride and arrogance, then these mental elements actually bring cause deterioration in your health as well, physical health as well. So the more self-centered and selfish you are, you become narrow-minded. The more narrow-minded you become, as we say, equalizing and equating and exchanging oneself with others, if you can practice that because of compassion, then you will be more calm and you will not harm others. You will not deceive others. You will not bully them. you will not be dishonest, you will be sincere with them, then you feel more relaxed. And but on the other hand, if you make this division between I and they, or then you will actually bully others and be dishonest to them, and you will feel guilty for what you do. We're not talking here about the past and future lives. So this is very important so these things which are taught in Buddhism, which could be used or to serve humanity, and of course we should use them to serve others. So it's not enough to have the Kanjuru and Tenjuru 300 and plus volumes on the altar, but we have to actually read them and then analyze the content. And we should not be satisfied with just scriptural quotations when we come to analyze and actually make some argument regarding certain points. It's not enough just to resort to scriptural citations, but we have to use logic and reasoning as we do in the study of logic and epistemology and Madhyamaka. So these 300 plus volumes are can be actually resort and rigorously checked through reason and logic. And we should not be satisfied merely with some knowledge as they are taught in the scriptures, but we have to actually give thought to them and then actually relate them to our life and practically. So I usually tell the Indian friends that they don't really study their teachings, but they actually recite some verses in Sanskrit and not really think about the meaning of them. So that's not enough. And so similarly, we have amongst Tibetans who do a similar thing, just use praying and not really giving thought to the teachings. As Buddhists, we must actually cultivate a faith which is reason-based, and it's not blind faith alone will not work. It's not enough. So from Tibet these days, we have some people, scholars, who actually bring up lots of arguments against the Dharma. So when such things happen, when you find such things, arguments against the Dharma, at least even if you don't externally argue with them, but for yourself, you can use reasonings against them to counter them, those scholars. Kedrup Jay has said that whether in Tibet there are non-Buddhists or not, but we all have the imprints in our mind of the contradictory philosophical views of the non-Buddhist traditions from our past lives. And so when we have people who are like arguing against the Dharma, of course, it gives us a challenge, which is very good. So for the last 2,000 years, we have actually been, Tibetans have been able to keep up with the Dharma through reason and logic. Sorry. So if we could actually gain certitude in our own traditions, in our philosophical systems, through reasoning, then we will be able to become someone, a follower of Buddhism, through reason. So for now, I'll stop here with the introductory remark. So we have come to the chapter on the section on the stages of path for beings with intermediate scope. So the root of the how to rely on the guru, the root of the path, and what to do, how to go about with the practice after having relied on them. So the Christians say that humans have souls, and some say even the animals have, but it seems generally they don't seem to have a soul. So from that point of view, we could say that even according to Christianity, we can say that human life is something precious. As the word Purusha kind of indicates, being having the ability to do things. And so having found such a human life with leisure and endowment, and so we should actually take advantage of this life by practicing the Dharma, the teachings pertaining to the beings of small and intermediate scope. So the main the uniqueness of Buddhism comes within the teaching of the beings of the intermediate scope. So when the Buddha gave the teachings on Four Noble Truths, he actually recited or taught it three times. First, introducing the nature of these Four Noble Truths, saying that there is suffering and there's origin of suffering which causes it, and then there is the possibility to actually put an end to the suffering and the path which leads to it. And so how do we go about with the practice of the Four Noble Truths as to what to adopt and what to discard? Then the Buddha said when we should understand suffering, overcome this origin, and actualize the cessation, and cultivate the path. And as a result of it, doing this, what will be the result? The Buddha, at the third repetition of the Four Noble Truths, he said, once you have understood that the final nature of the suffering, and origin of suffering, having put an end to it, there is no more understanding suffering and overcoming suffering as such. And then once you have actualized the cessation, there is nothing to be actualized. And once you have cultivated the path within yourself, then there is no more path to be cultivated as such. So this is how you go about with the practice of the Dharma. So the reason for giving the teaching on the Four Noble Truths is the for the 12 links of dependent origination, and it shows how the 12 the Four Noble Truths actually work. So in the 12 links, it begins with ignorance as the cause of our karma leading to leaving imprint on the consciousness, and then ending with aging and death. And then it also, within that the teaching on the 12 links, it said that when once ignorance is stopped, then the rest of the chain also stops. So these are not mere imaginations, but actually we're talking about reality. And so the teaching on the Four Noble Truths is something practical and realistic. So His Holiness is trying to find some phrase in Lam Rim Chemo, but he couldn't find it, but it will come. So the actual meditation on suffering, reflection on that has two parts, reflection on the universal suffering of cyclic existence and reflection on specific sufferings. Reflection on universal sufferings of cycling existence is divided into three: reflection on the eight types of suffering, six types of suffering, and the three types of suffering. Reflection on the eight types of suffering. Meditate on, in accordance with what is said in Nagarjuna's friendly letter, Your Highness, be disenchanted with cyclic existence, which is the origin of many sufferings, being deprived of what you want, death, illness, old age, and so on. Here, cultivating a sense of disenchantment with cyclic existence means reflecting on it as the origin of many sufferings. The eight types of suffering include the four that Nagarjuna states explicitly, being deprived of what one wants, and so forth, as well as the four that are indicated by words, and so on. The Bhagavan taught these eight in many discourses when he identified the truth of suffering. And then it goes on. During every session in which you meditate on the teachings shared with persons of medium capacity, take up as well the shared teachings that I explained in the section on the practice appropriate to persons of small capacity. As for the teachings that are not shared with persons of small capacity, if your mind is strong, sustain them in meditation in exactly the way that I have written them here. If it is weak, then leave out the scriptural citations and only meditate on the meaning of the points I have outlined. Though these are analytical meditations, you should nonetheless arrest excitement and so on with regard to your mental object, not taking up any object, virtuous, non-virtuous, or ethically neutral other than that which you are meditating upon, without letting your mind fall under the influence of sleep, lethargy, or laxity. Meditate continually in a state of consciousness that is very clear and pure. For as engaging in Bodhisattva deeds says, there will be a little result from any virtuous practice if mind is distracted. The one who knows reality has said that prayers, austerities, and such, even if practiced for a long time, even if are pointless, if done with distracted mind. So the eight types of sufferings are mainly to do with the our empirical experience as humans. So they're talking mainly about human life. And then the next topic is the suffering of birth. Birth, as there are five points to contemplate it. Birth is suffering because it is associated with pain. Birth is suffering because it is associated with dysfunctional tendencies. So regarding this, those born as hell beings, hungry ghosts, and who invariably suffer, beings born from a womb and beings born from an egg. So when we look at animals giving birth to their babies, and they have to really go through so much pain, and this is similar. It is similarly the case with humans. So a birth which is brought about by our delusions and karma, and we can talk about here, relate this to a biological factor. So birth is suffering because it is associated with dysfunctional tendencies. So what this shows is that
So unless we work to end this tide of suffering, this kind of birth, which is brought about by our destructive emotions and karma, of course the suffering will naturally come once we have this kind of psychophysical aggregate. All the compositional factors of the three realms, because they are associated with dysfunctional tendencies that are in harmony with the class of afflictions, are ill-suited to the service of virtue and uncontrollable. So if we think along about this kind of suffering, so our life which is brought about by our delusions and karma, and you will feel that once you understand that, you will feel that there's you can't help without actually going against or overcoming it. And moreover, once you possess the compositional factors of living beings within the three realms, you too are bound to dysfunctional tendencies and are in harmony with the class of afflictions. So we have this life or body which is brought about by our karma and delusions. And so there is the birth is suffering because it is the origin of suffering. And birth is suffering because it is the origin of the afflictions. The afflictions torment your body and mind in numerous ways. So this body is obtained, has been obtained through because of the past delusions and karma. And while we have this body, it also helps to give rise to our afflictions and karma again. Birth is suffering because it is an unwanted separation. All births end in death, which is undesirable and causes you to experience only suffering. Thus, at birth, you are bound to pain and endowed with dysfunctional tendencies. Birth leads to illness, aging, and so forth, as well as the afflictions and death. Consider how these give rise to suffering as well. So we can actually empirically see that how when someone is overcome with anger or attachment and greed, they cause trouble to themselves as well. If we look at animals as well, animals are dogs which are very angry, even other dogs will not come around it. Whereas if a dog is very gentle, then others also come around. So if you are very selfish and thinking only about yourself all the time, then you will not be happy at all. Even this is the case, even with dogs and other animals. And so these are things, something which we can actually... So we are talking here about the subtleties, the degrees of subtlety within the afflictive emotions. When it comes to the very subtle level of afflictions or the disturbing emotions, then even those which the Savatantrika Madhyamakas consider to be very subtle become, from the vantage point of the Prasangikas, they are found to be gross. So there are those afflictions which actually and have some object that they take on the aspect of. And then there are very subtle ones. So the philosophical traditions which consider, which actually accept some objectivity in things, would consider those afflictions which are subtle to be valid or a correct state of mind or cognition. In particular, the suffering you undergo in the womb is as described in Chandra Komin's letter to a student. So when we think about the impermanence, suffering, the four attributes of the First Noble Truth, this is what is taught here. So when regarding the subtle impermanence, the mere fact that something actually ceases or is disintegrates is because of its cause, which has brought about, which has which brings it about. So if we think closely, we are all like a slave to our ignorance. And so because of this king of ignorance, we have all its servants which actually subject us to suffering. So therefore, there is no choice but to actually go against the ignorance. So you cannot just be angry and make faces to it, but you actually have to develop to the understanding of reality as it is to counter this ignorance. Thus, at birth, you are bound to pain and endowed with dysfunctional tendencies. Birth leads to illness, aging, and so forth, as well as the afflictions and death. Consider how these give rise to suffering as well. And after you have gender garments, letter of student says, after you have entered the womb, which is like hell, you are hemmed in by foul-smelling filth and trapped in pitch-dark gloom, your body cramped, you must undergo enormous suffering. The descent into Lanka Sutra, Womb Sutra, explains the meaning of these words. Filthy with quantities of urine, brain-like substances, thick saliva and marrow, the fetus dwells above the intestines and below the stomach in a space which is filled with many kinds of filth and is home to a myriad of bacteria with two very foul-smelling openings and hollows and apertures in the bones. Its front faces the vertebrae and its back, the stomach wall. It is nourished every month by its mother's uterine blood. The bits of food its mother has eaten are ground by her two rows of teeth and swallowed. As it is swallowed, the food is moistened from below by saliva and the oozing of mouth sores, while it is polluted from above by thick saliva. The remains of that vomit-like food enter from above through the umbilical cords, opening the generate growth. Through the thickening, quivering, and elongated and globular stages, the embryo is completely transformed into a fetus with arms and legs. The placenta encloses its arms, legs, and cheeks, reeking like an old placenta, like an old rag used for mucus. The stench is unbearable, and shrouded in pitch darkness, it moves up and down. The bitter, sour, pungent, salty, spicy, and astringent taste of food affect it like hot coals, like an intestinal worm. It feeds on filthy fluids. It finds itself in a swamp that oozes rotting filth. Its life force is unstable. The heat of its mother's body torments, heats, and overheats it all the three in 3 degrees, slightly, moderately, and greatly. It experiences distressing, intense, violent, and unbearable agony. Whenever its mother moves a little, moderately, or greatly, it also moves in the same way, constrained by five bonds. It experiences agony that is distressing, intense, violent, unbearable, and almost inconceivable, as though it had been thrust into a pit of burning cinders. Similarly, it is said that the fetus is harmed in the womb when the mother eats too much or too little, eats food that is too oily, pungent, cold, hot, salty, sour, bitter, sweet, bitter, spicy, or astringent, indulges her sexual desires, runs too much or too fast, jumps or swims, or sits or squats in front of the fire. It is also said that the fetus is confined by the stomach and held firm by the intestine as though it were bound by five bonds or impaled on a stake. There is even further suffering when the infant emerges from the womb and is born into the outside. Chandra Gomin's letter to students says, it is crushed slowly like sesame seed in an oil press, and then somehow it is born. It is born. Nonetheless, those who do not lose their lives immediately must settle for pain. The body that dwelt and grew in that filth is smeared with the warm slime and has an unbearable foul. Memory is lost upon being inflicted with such torment, which is like having an inflamed boiled burst, or being on the verge of vomiting. The descent into the womb explains the meaning of these words. Then the quotation from that sutra. It is then after that, it is said that when taken up onto someone's lap and the like, or touched with hot or cold objects, the newborn baby experiences distressing, intense, violent, and unbearable agony, like a flayed cow being eaten by vermin or a leper whose lesions are struck with a whip. Among the eight types of suffering, regard this first type, along with the eight types, the suffering of the five appropriated aggregates as the most crucial, and meditate upon both of them. Therefore, as explained before, you should repeatedly investigate them with discerning wisdom and meditate on them. The suffering of old age. There are 5 points to contemplate. A handsome body deteriorates, physical strength and vigor deteriorate, the senses deteriorate, enjoyment of sense objects fades, the deterioration of life is painful. Think about these points again and again. As the extensive Sports Sutra says, as aging progresses and we pass to a certain point, we are like trees struck by lightning, withered by old age, like a terrible, decrepit house. O sage, speak quickly about an escape from old age. Age enfeebled the masses of men and women as a windstorm strips vines from the groves of sal trees. Age steals our vigor, skill, and strength. It is as though we are struck in mud. Age makes attractive bodies unattractive. Age steals our glory and our strength. Age steals our happiness and subjects us to insults. Age takes our vigor. Age begets death. Jianghava said, the pain of death is horrible but brief. How horrible is aging? Gamapa said, it is well that aging happens little by little. If it happened all at once, it would be intolerable. The suffering of illness. Here there are also 5 points. Illness changes the nature of the body. Pain and anguish increases and are seldom absent. There is no desire for attractive things. You must have recourse, however unwillingly, to unpleasant objects, and you lose your vital energy. So reflect with care upon these points. As the extensive Sports Sutra says, hundreds of illnesses and the pains of rampant disease inflict us just as humans oppress wild animals. Regard the beings overwhelmed by old age and disease and quickly speak about escape from suffering. In deep winter, wind and glade blizzards take the vigor from the grasses, shrubs, trees, and herbs. In the same way, disease takes the vigor out of living beings and it breaks down their faculties, physical appearance, and strength. It will drain a great fortune in wealth and grain to the last. Disease constantly humiliates living beings. It harms them and is contemptuous of beauty. It torments them like the sun beating down from the sky. The suffering of death. Again, there are 5 points to contemplate. You are separated from objects that are fine and attractive. You are separated from those relatives who are fine and attractive. You are separated from companions who are fine and attractive. You are deprived of a body that is fine and attractive. As you die, you experience terrible pain and anguish. Reflect on these repeatedly until you become disenchanted. How do the first four of these constitute suffering? You suffer upon seeing that you are losing these four excellent things. The extensive Sports Sutra says, you die and pass on to another life, and in doing so, you are forever separated from people who are beautiful and beloved. Like a leaf fallen from a tree or current of river, you will never return and meet them again. Death makes the powerful weak. Death takes you away as a river carries away a log. People go alone, unaccompanied, with no companion. powerless because their karma has its effects. Death seizes myriad living beings as sea monsters seize swarms of creatures, as an eagle seizes a snake, or a lion an elephant, as fire takes hold of grass, trees, and swarming creatures. The suffering of encountering what is unpleasant. Here there are also 5 points to contemplate. Merely encountering your enemies, for example, causes pain and anguish. You dwell in fear of being punished by them. You fear they will speak maliciously without kind words. You dread death. You worry that you will go to a miserable realm after death for having acted in ways contrary to the teaching. Reflect on these. The suffering of separation from what is pleasant. Again, there are 5 points to contemplate. When you are separated from a very dear relative, for example, in your mind, sorrow arises. In your speech, you lament. You bring harm to your own body. You are saddened, recalling and missing the good qualities of what you have lost. Recourse in no longer available for what you have lost. Reflect on these. The suffering of not getting what you want. So the first and the last of the eight types of suffering are said to be the most important. And so the eighth one is this, the suffering of 5 appropriate aggregates. So it's a vessel for future suffering. So it actually serves as a concordant factor for bringing up about more suffering, which means the psychophysical aggregate brought about by delusion and karma bring this about. So because of our grasping at true existence of things and creating karma because of that, having actually been born in such a life with this body and psychophysical aggregate, such a psychophysical aggregate brings about more suffering and serves as the basis for more suffering, and therefore you have more suffering. A vessel for suffering based on what presently exists, vessel for the suffering of pain, vessels for suffering of change, and vessels for the suffering of continuationality. Reflect on these again and again. As I said yesterday, thus, this psychophysical aggregate, which is brought about by common delusion, if you meditate on how much suffering there is, such as suffering of injury and so forth, it will stir within you this wish to go out of suffering. Here, with regard to the first point, you induce suffering in future lives by taking up these appropriate aggregates. As for the second, the appropriate aggregates form a basis for states such as illness and old age that are grounded in the already existing aggregates. The third and the fourth both will come about because the appropriate aggregates are linked with dysfunctional tendencies. Now, towards these two types of suffering, as regards the fifth, the very existence of the appropriate aggregates constitute the nature of the suffering of conditionality, because all of the compositional factors which depend on previous karma and afflictions are the suffering of conditionality. This will be explained in detail in the section on the three sufferings. So, in the three the principal parts of the path, being swept by the powerful four currents, and bound by the tight ropes of karma and afflictions, and they're trapped inside the iron mesh of self-grasping, they're enveloped from everywhere by thick. By pitch darkness of ignorance. So the four powerful rivers refer to river currents refers to the birth, sickness, aging, and death. And then the fetters of karma, this tight, which bind us tightly. is brought about by the self-grasping, the iron mesh of self-grasping, and this strong sense of notion of an I and grasping at this self, and also the psychophysical aggregate on the basis of which we have the sense of an I, all these are brought about by the self-grasping. And so, whether it's about the external world or internal experience, they appear to have some objective existence to us. But if we could as they appear to have objective existence, we also kind of hold on to that way of existence of things. And whatever experience we have, we always have a very strong notion of some kind of a solid nature of these of objective existence, and therefore we are enveloped by a pitch darkness of ignorance. This is true. So if there were some side from which a light comes, of course we wouldn't be in this kind of thick darkness. But here, because of this ignorance, then we have self-grasping. And then, because of that, we create the karmas and go through these four types of suffering. And then they take rebirth, so we take rebirth within cycling existence that has no end, where they are endlessly tormented. You are tormented by the three types of suffering. By reflecting on all of those, when you think about your condition being such, then you will be able to develop the sense or the determination to be free from this kind of condition for yourself. And when you actually turn it towards the others, reflecting on all your mothers who suffer such conditions, then you will generate the supreme awakening mind, or the compassion. So the last paragraph on page 279, Buddha said, as soon as we are born, any one of the six types of beings, we are faced with the suffering of sickness, death, and so on. When the cause of sickness is present, we are sick. And so, this is not because you have very little merit, but because you have this body and mind which have come through delusion and karma, these are bound to happen. And so this is neither appropriate nor accidental. It is character of or nature of cycling existence. While we are in cycling existence, there is no escaping it. If we are disgusted by it, then we must eliminate the process of birth. To do this, we must eliminate its causes. Reflecting this way on the arising of suffering, explained above, sufferings of birth, old age, illness, death, and so forth. Then reflection on the six types of suffering, page 281. And then the first one, the fault of uncertainty. And the fault of insatiability. And there are quotations from the friendly letter and also companion of perfections. And Chandra Gomin's letter to a student. Kundarambuja said, a very best friend of yours becomes your sworn enemy the next day because of some mistake that you make, something you say about that person. So people become suspicious for what they say about you, and because of that, then they develop distrust, and because of which they develop anxiety and disliking, and then they start thinking to harm you. And covetousness also happens. So furthermore, you will become very disenchanted if you reflect on what the alleviating sorrow says. So Milarepa has said, may my death be not hurt by known to the my enemies and friends. So Milarepa was saying that and has said that if he were to die without other people knowing his near and dear ones as his enemies, his wishes as a hermit is fulfilled. So whatever he does, he prays that they may become factors for helping others, for the well-being of others. And so the four ways of carrying oneself about, according to the Kadamba masters, are also very good. That you think about the Dharma alone, and while practicing the Dharma, you live as a mendicant. And as mendicants, you live in places which are hostile, and be able to do your practice. But for to be able to do this, you should actually have the understanding of the entire structure of Buddhism. For example, in the Kagyu tradition, you have in Mahamudra practice, there are the practices of Dzogchen, the single-pointedness, one taste, and non-meditation, and so forth. So you have to actually understand how to go about with the entire practice of the teaching, the Buddha Dharma. It's an entirety, and then integrate those teachings within yourself and live in live as hermit and in remote places. So you have to see the pros and cons of your the different practices, and so with regard to the first Dalai Lama, Gelun Drupa, of course, when he was in living as hermit, he was really making lots of progress, spiritual progress. And then where he had the opportunity to progress further and further into the higher experiences of Dharma, while he was living in Gangjin hermitage, and then later he built the Tashilhimbu monasteries. And so later he instructed his advised his disciples that I actually forsaked or my own practice and came to build this monastery. And so you have to really be very careful. So Master, the first Dalai Lama was able to really leave a great legacy for, in terms of his the preservation and promotion of the Dharma. But there are other masters who are who actually have very few disciples and live in remote places. So, so even if you gained the vast wonders of cyclic existence, you would be illusory. They would be illusory. Bear in mind the countless bodies you have wasted in the past, experiencing limitless and pointless suffering. Consider that it will continue this way unless you make an effort to put an end to it. Develop a sense of disenchantment. Zhang Hua said, "Honorable teachers, how many bodies have you taken from beginless time? Now, since you never practiced Mahayana teachings, you must apply yourself assiduously." Sangpuwa said, "In this cyclical existence, there are many turns of fortune for better or for worse. Do not stake your hopes on them. Reflect until you give rise to this kind of thinking. After you have developed it, you must continue to sustain it in meditation." And the next is the fault of casting off bodies repeatedly. The friendly letter says, "Each of us has left a pile of bones that would dwarf Mount Meru. For each living being, if the bones discarded upon taking up new bodies did not disappear, they would tower over even Mount Meru." Next is the fault of repeated rebirth. If you looked for the limits of mothers by counting with earthen pellets the size of juniper berries, the earth would not suffice. So earlier, scholars took this to mean that each pellet represents a living being who has been your mother, but this is incorrect. The clear words explanation of the friendly letter cites a sutra which indicates that that it refers to the line of matrilineal predecessors from one's own mother to her mother and so forth. Again, the reading of those former scholars is wrong because Nagarjuna texts says the limit of mothers. You should understand how this causes you to be disenchanted as follows. The 400 stanzas say, "You cannot see the initial cause of even a single effect. Seeing how vast the causes of even one effect are, who would not be frightened?" Chandrakirti's commentary on this says, "It is right to cultivate a constant sense of disenchantment and a corresponding mode of conduct in the face of this vast wilderness, cyclic existence, where movement is difficult on account of the dense forest of ignorance whose riches cannot be measured." The fault of repeatedly descending upon from high to low is the fifth point. The friendly letters, quotation from friendly letter. And the three devices for grinding, cutting, and tearing flesh are those of crushing, black line, and extremely hot hells, respectively. To be attended by divine women means to be served by goddesses. The pleasures of deities in the desire realm refers to the deities in the desire realm from the heaven of the 33 and above. Here, the light of the sun and the moon is described in terms of that are familiar to ordinary people without distinguishing between the supports, the palace of the deities, and what is supported the deities. If you do distinguish them, then the light is the light of the palace of sun and moon. Considering all the ways that you can fall from high to low places, as illustrated by these examples, you should be disenchanted with cycling existence because all of its wonders will collapse at the end, as the basis of disciplined states. The end of accumulated things is depletion. The end of things that are high is a fall. The end of meetings is separation. The end of life is death. And number six, the fault of having no companions. The friendly letter says, "In this way, you'll come to grief. Therefore, take light from the lamp of the three types of merit. Otherwise, you'll go alone into endless darkness that neither sun nor moon can penetrate." You'll come to a grief means know that you must die, as I have indicated before, and take the light of merit. The three types of merit refers either to physical, verbal, or mental virtue, or to the three foundations from which merit arises, generosity, and so on. Endless darkness refers to the darkness of ignorance. In regard to having no companions, engaging in the bodhisattva deeds, says this body comes forth whole, yet the bones and flesh that accompany it will break apart and disperse, as this is so. My why mentioned others, such as love. So this verse under the subsection, the fault of having no companions, the verse from friendly letter is actually a great summary. So however high great authority you may have, rich you may be, you at the time of death, you can take nothing, not even a single paisa or a single penny. So in this way, the base of disciplines states, the statement from the base of discipline just before that, the end of accumulated things, everything that has collected ends in depletion, the things which go up must come down, and the end of meetings is separation, and the end of life is death. So you are born alone, also you die alone. As others cannot share your suffering, of what use is the hindrance of loved ones? So during the time of birth and death, we cannot do much. You cannot actually take anybody that you consider to be your relatives or your friends and so forth. So thus, these six faults comprise three types. In cyclic, there is no secure basis for you that you can count on. However much you may indulge in its pleasure, they will not bring satisfaction in the end. You have been caught in cyclic existence from beginningless time. The first of these has four parts to it. And the third of these four refers to being reborn again and again. There are no limits to the stream of rebirths. Reflect on suffering under this threefold arrangements as well. And the next is meditation on the three types of suffering. The suffering of change, so when you have pains from some sickness, that is the suffering of suffering. So pleasant feelings experience. So the painful experience that you have from some sickness is suffering of suffering. So you are inflicted with a very intense suffering or disease. But when that excruciating pain subsides, it's like you are undergoing the suffering of change, and still the root cause of that painful experience is still there. In the suffering of pain, and then the suffering of conditionality. So thus, attachment increases when a pleasant feeling arises, and acidity increases when pain arises. Ignorance increases when you misapprehend the body, which is part of a dysfunctional situation that is neither pleasant nor painful as permanent. So within the ignorance, of course, there are going to be very degrees of subtlety. When it is so as permanent, when it is in fact impermanent, attachment gives rise to suffering, such as future rebirth in the five realms of the hell realm and so forth. Hostility brings about. So in the Pramana Vartika, it says that ignorance is the root of the birth in cyclic existence. But once you have created a karma through ignorance, it is actually revitalized by craving, reinforced by it in order to take rebirth. So hostility brings about suffering such as sorrow in this life as well as the future sufferings of miserable realms, while ignorance acts in such a way as to maintain in existence the sufferings produced by the other two, attachment and hostility. Therefore, attachment ceases when you see pleasant feelings as suffering. In the case of painful feelings, hostility ceases when you consider that since these aggregates of body and mind are a collection of causes for suffering, painful feelings arises from them as physical afflictions does. So in the Lakdong Chemo, the insight section, the reality is also explained in terms of the coarser level and the subtle. So it says, I have explained these points in accordance with the compendium of determinations and levels of the yogic deeds. So here, this has made the comment regarding this line. So therefore, since the suffering of conditionality pervades all suffering and is the root of the other two types of suffering, meditate on it often in order to become disenchanted with it. Moreover, your current pleasant feelings mostly arise only upon the relief of suffering. So we actually draw some kind of a pleasure based on the sensory experiences, such as beautiful sights, interesting music, and fragrant smell or sweet taste and pleasant touch. So these are not actually very stable. They do not last. So while the sights and sounds and so forth are there, you will draw some pleasure. But once they are not there, then you will not be happy. In fact, you may feel rather sad. But based on the mind, if you could generate some virtuous state of mind or cultivate patience, these do not depend on sensory perceptions. So the sensory perceptions actually come into being, or they arise when the objects, the respective objects are there, the sights, sounds, and so forth are there, whereas the cognition, our thoughts do not have to necessarily depend on these objects. So we usually talk about the sense objects or sensual objects, and most of the people try to draw some kind of satisfaction or contentment based on that they draw based on the sensory experiences. So animals also do that. So when they see other animals of their own species, they are happy, and when they hear sounds or noise of their own species, they are happy. But using their own mind, they cannot actually use their own mind to draw such pleasure, whereas humans can do that. So since we have this very special intelligence, this body that we have is also considered as a high status. So physically, we are in high status, but mentally, if we are more or less lost to our sensory experiences and are mentally we are same as animals and not of high status. And if you're actually and use your speech, use your power of language to write about things which have to only to do with sensory gratification, and that's not very, the voice is also not of high status. And therefore, we should make this mind and our speech those of that of high status, just as this body is. So we should use our minds to do things which others cannot do, and if we could also use our speech for the same purpose, then we will be making our mind and speech of high status. So we are in this desire realm, of course. And accordingly, people usually indulge in drawing gratification on the basis of sensory experiences. So they try to draw some bliss or pleasure based on sensory experiences, but what happens as a result is they have mentally, they are full of suffering and misery. And they do not have the means to actually develop pleasant experiences using their own mind, but resort to the sensory experiences alone for that. So the most of the unpleasant experiences actually come because of their way of thinking, using their own mind. And so this cannot be overcome by pleasant sights or pleasant sounds, but you have to actually be overcome it by using your own mind, such as, for example, the experiences of anxiety, fear, and so forth, should be overcome by using your mind. So the sensory trying to draw sensory pleasure or gratification is not so great. Moreover, your current pleasant feelings which cause attachment to grow mostly arise only upon the relief of suffering. Pleasure does not exist naturally, independently of the removal of suffering. For example, if you suffer because of too much walking, a pleasant state of mind arises when you sit down. Then, as the earlier intense sufferings fade, pleasure appears to arise gradually. Yet sitting is not naturally pleasant, because if you sit too long, suffering arises again, just as before. Suppose that sitting and other postures were causes of pleasure by their very nature. Just as suffering increases in proportion to your involvement with causes of suffering, so should pleasure increase the longer you walk, sit, lie down, drink, or eat, or stand in the sun or shade. However, it is clear that if you do any of these for too long, suffering is all that results. So, if these were pleasure, such as sitting and so forth, were pleasure by nature, then the more you indulge in them, the more pleasure you should be able to draw. But that's not the case, as the passage continues. Just as suffering increases in proportion to your involvement with causes of suffering, so should pleasure increase the longer you walk, sit, lie, and so forth. However, it is clear that if you do these too long, suffering is all that results. And then for as the descent in the womb sutra says in the same vein, Nanda, physical activities of walking, sitting, standing, or lying down must each be understood as suffering. If meditators analyze the nature of these physical activities, they will see that if they spend the day walking and do not rest, sit down or lie down, they will experience walking exclusively as suffering and will experience intense, sharp, unbearable, unpleasant feelings. The notion that walk is pleasant, it will not arise. After discussing the other three physical activities in the same way, the text continues. And also in the 400 stanzas, the pleasure, when it increases, is seen to change into pain. Pain, when it increases, does not likewise change into pleasure. And next section is reflection on specific suffering. So we'll move on. We'll switch to middle length lamrim.
Oh.
Shortcomings of cyclic existence. The thing about shortcomings of cyclic existence in general. Considering the suffering of cyclic existence in general as two parts, considering the eight types of suffering, considering the six types of suffering, and considering the suffering of there's eight types of suffering, considering the suffering of birth, suffering of aging, the suffering of illness, suffering of death, and suffering of meeting with the unpleasant, the suffering of separation from the pleasant, and suffering of seeking what you desire and not getting it, and the suffering, the meaning of the statements in brief, the five appropriate chit aggregates are suffering. The suffering of birth. Birth is suffering because it is associated with suffering, and so forth. And then considering the suffering of aging. This has 5 points. The complete deterioration of your fine body is such that your spine becomes carved like a bell, your head becomes white like moss flowers, your forehead becomes covered with wrinkles like a cutting board, and so on, whereby the splendor of youth deteriorates and you turn ugly, the deterioration of power and strength, and the deterioration of senses in such a way that the eyes and so forth do not see clearly perceived forms and so forth, and your mindfulness and so forth diminish and grow, as you grow forgetful and so forth. And fourth, the enjoyment of sense objects declines. Food and drinks become difficult to digest, and you can no longer enjoy other pleasures. The suffering of the lifespan having deteriorated completely is that due to your lifespan, having been at last spent, you face death. You should think about these points again and again. Chengava said the suffering of death is vicious but brief. This aging process is vicious indeed. Kamava said it's good that old age comes gradually, bit by bit. If it came in a single moment and all at once, it would be unbearable. Considering the suffering of illness has 5 points. The nature of body changes in that the flesh becomes loose, the skin dries up, and so forth. Suffering and mental unhappiness increases, and you predominantly dwell in them. The bodily constituents, water, and so forth become disturbed in strength as they lose their proportional balance, producing pain in the body that in turn causes mental unhappiness lasting day and night. You lack the desire. Number three, you lack the desire to enjoy pleasant things. And four, you need to undergo the unpleasant against your will. And five, you will be separated from your life. You should consider these points in detail. Considering the death, suffering of death, this has 5 points. You are separated from the excellent possessions, relatives, companions, as well as your lovely body, and at the time of death, you experience suffering and intense mental unhappiness. As long as you have not become distressed at these types of suffering, you should think them over again and again. The way in which the first four become suffering is that having seen that you will be separated from those four, you suffer. Considering the suffering of the meeting with unpleasant, the next is considering the suffering of separation from the pleasant. And consider the suffering of seeking what you what you desire and not getting it. And considering the meaning of the subject statement, in brief, the five appropriated aggregates are suffering. This has 5 points. You should think about these points again and again. Independent on taking these appropriated aggregates, the suffering of the next rebirth onwards are induced. The aggregates that have already been established become the basis of illness, aging, and so forth, which depends on them. If no genuine disenchantment develops towards cyclic existence, which is of the nature of the appropriated aggregates, there's no way a genuine mind striving for liberation will develop, and great compassion with the sentient beings wandering in cyclic existence cannot develop either. Therefore, these considerations are extremely important whichever vehicle you enter, the Mahayana or Hinayana. Considering the six types of suffering, the lack of certainty, insatiability, discarding one's body again and again, being reborn again and again, changing from high to low again and again, and lacking companions. To reduce them to three, in the cyclic existence, there's nothing reliable. No matter how much of its happiness you enjoy, there is no final point of satisfaction, and you have been in it since beginningless time. The first has 4 points. The inappropriateness of relying on the body you have attained, you will discard your body again and again. The inappropriateness of relying on the benefit and harm done to you, there is no certainty as to whether your father will become your son, your mother, your wife, an enemy, someone very dear to you, and the like. The inappropriateness of relying on the excellences you have achieved, you fall from high places to low ones, and the inappropriateness of relying on companions, you have to go on without them in the end. The third one of this is that you are reborn again and again, and end to the continuity of birth is not evident. You should reflect on these manners again and again. Furthermore, at the present, most of the happy feelings that increase our attachment of minds of happiness that arise with respect to a relief of suffering, yet So, reflection on specific sufferings on Lamrim Chemo, page 292. Of the six kinds of specific sufferings, I have already explained above the sufferings of three miserable realms. The suffering of human beings, one, the suffering of demigods, and the reflection on the suffering of the deities. And then the suffering of dying and falling, the suffering of dying, the friendly letter says, although the deities have great pleasure in heaven, the suffering of dying there is even greater than that. The wise who understand this cease to create attachment towards for the perishable heavens. Deities derive pleasure from indulging their sensual desires, yet greater than this is the tremendous suffering they experience while dying, and when they become aware of the five signs of death about which this same text says, their bodies turn an unattractive color, their cushions become uncomfortable, their flower garlands wilt, and their clothing smells, and unaccustomed sweat breaks out over their bodies. The five signs that signal the deities in the heaven foretelling their death and departure, therefore, The Brahma is similar to the signs that foretell death for humans on earth and the suffering, next suffering of falling to lower realms. The friendly letter says that they must take leave the divine worlds. If their marriage has run out, then powerless, they will become animals, hunger ghosts, or denizens of hells, and the suffering of anxiety. Deities with vast stores of merit gain the most desirable objects. Upon seeing them, deities of lesser merit become anxious and experience great anguish and pain on this account. And the sufferings of being cut, gushed, killed, and banished. When deities fight with demigods, they undergo the pain of having their limbs and minor extremities cut off, having their bodies split apart and being killed. When their heads are cut off, they die, but their other limbs regenerate after being cut off or gashed, and they survive. As regards banishment, when there is a battle, the more powerful deities expel the weaker deities from their homes. Moreover, as Vasubandhu's discussion of the requisite collection says, deities who indulge in sensual pleasures are not happy in mind. They are burnt by an inner fire sparked by the infection of sensual desire. How can there be happiness for those whose minds are distracted? Since their minds are not under control and are undistracted, even for a moment, they are by nature disturbed and agitated. They will never be calm like a fire that has wood for fuel and that rages whipped by the wind. Also, and then next is deities of the forms of formless realms. And then page 298, reflections on the process of cyclic existence in terms of its origin. The origin of cyclic existence is explained in three parts: how the afflictions arise, how you thereby accumulate karma, and how you die and are reborn. And then, how the afflictions arise. Karma and afflictions are both necessary as causes for the creation of cyclic existence, but the afflictions are primary. For just as a seed without moisture, soil, etc., will not produce sprouts, so in the absence of afflictions, they'll. Even though you have accumulated immeasurable karma in the past, there will be no sprout of suffering because the karma lacks the necessary cooperating conditions. A further reason afflictions are primary is because even without previously accumulated karma, if afflictions are present, you immediately accumulate new karma and will thereby appropriate aggregates in the future. Similarly, Dharmakirti's commentary on the Compendium of Valid Cognition says, the karma that one who has transcended craving for existence lacks the potency to project another birth because its corporate conditions are gone. So because of the subtlety in within the afflictions, negative thoughts and emotions, they can actually cause different degrees of unwanted suffering. they actually cause disturbance in the peace of mind. The very subtle ones, actually, the very subtle afflictions or negative thoughts and emotions actually disturb our peace of mind in a very subtle way. So it comes in under the category, under the title or topic, Identifying the Afflictions. An affliction is defined as a phenomena that, when it arises, is disturbing and in character, and that, through arising, disturbs the mind stream. Thus, when it is produced, it disturbs the mind stream. So the specific definitions of the 10 afflictions are as follows. Attachment means noticing a pleasant or unattractive external or internal object and desiring it. When attachment clings to its object and grows stronger, it is hard to tear yourself away from the object, just as it is difficult to remove oil which has soaked into cloth. So wouldn't there be cases where that you of becoming anger by actually thinking about suffering itself? Hostility means observing the origins of suffering, such as living beings, pain, weapons, thorns, and giving rise to a harsh torment of mind, and contemplates harming these. So ignorance here is the mere not knowing, and doubt. Here we have to understand this doubt as afflicted doubt. So mere doubt, just doubt by itself is not something that is negative. In the mental factors, we talk about doubt, which is afflicted doubt, because doubt is something that is necessary. When you actually doubt about something, then you will actually check for its truth, or whether it's right or wrong, or and your investigation, you will do investigation into the thing. Without by doing that, then you will actually see the reality, the truth. Without being able to investigate, you will not be able to find the truth. So doubt here is afflicted doubt, means considering those three, the four truths, the karma and effects, and the three jewels, and being uncertain whether they exist or are real. The reifying view of the perishing aggregates is an afflictive intelligence that observes the appropriate aggregates and regards them as I or mine, that is, as the self or that which belongs to the self. Those who are born in as in the animal realms for eons and eons, even the animals have the sense of an I or grasping at a self, although they do not have the sense of an I which is separate from the aggregates. So when Chandrakirti says this, that although the animals do not have that sense of an I which is separate from the body and the mind, but they still have the grasping at a self. So here, perishing means impermanent, and aggregates is plural. The terms indicate that what are apprehended as simply impermanent and multiple phenomena, there is no permanent and unitary person. This is why it is called the view of perishing aggregates. So we have a notion of a self, for example, as permanent, unitary, and autonomous, which is merely actually designed through philosophical concerns. And then there is a second type of grasping at itself, which is grasping at some kind of an independent or substantial self. When you think about an I, you think that the aggregates, mind and body, are like its belongings. So although you have that kind of sense that the self is actually designated on the basis of the psychophysical aggregate, but you have a feeling or a notion that there is an I or a self which is independent from it. So self-sufficient, the substantial I, the grasping at this, there could be two types. One which is actually which sees the self as not being different from in character from the psychophysical aggregates, and this one could have an innate one. So when you think about your body or your mind now, of course you will not think that this body now and this body, the mind that you have now, are were there at the time of birth. But then you still think, you still have this notion that I was born at that time. And so the I seems to have been there. This, and when you think also about the past life, coming from the past life, you say, I came from the past life, and I was born at that time. So perhaps there is this sense of self-sufficiently, substantial, substantially existing I, which is different from the psychophysical aggregates. So although we use the same term, grasping at a self, which is the root of samsara, you have to think, give a lot of thought to it. So of course when you're in the debate courtyard, you will think about it, but even while you are alone sitting in your room, you should actually think about this, how this self arises or appears to your mind. You should not just repeat what is said in the scriptures, but you should give thought to it. Just think for yourself. Of course, these negative emotions there are there within ourselves, so we have to give thought to them. So how does this grasping at a self, which actually perceives a truly existing self, actually arises in you? So you can actually confirm to from your experience, if you give thought to it, and how it arises within yourself. But after having seen that this self, this independently or truly existing self, is not really there, but then in your intellectual, through your intellectual investigation, but when you actually in your day-to-day life look at things and yourself, think about yourself, they appear to have some independent existence. So although things appear to have some objective independent existence, but then from your by using your logic and that you from your own experience, when you think about them, whether that way of existence is not there, you will be able to find that you will not that there is no such a way of existence. And so, what you confirm from there is conclude from there is although things appear to have some objective existence, but there is no such way of existence. And therefore, you come to the conclusion that they are merely designated by this, by labels and names. And even that name that you use to label things with does not have any independent existence. So, as Ratnavali says, that the name itself will not is not there, and so when you think further, you'll be able to actually destroy all objectification or reification of things. So, to actually by thinking about emptiness, if you are not able to actually gain insight into how these the afflictions, negative thoughts and emotions actually arise by understanding emptiness, it's really rather difficult to actually to gain insight into what these negative emotions are and what they do. So by thinking about the Four Noble Truths and particularly the true cessation, then you will be able to confirm the truth of cessation, the nirvana, Otherwise, if there's a possibility to put an end to the suffering, the appropriated aggregates which come from delusion and karma, when you see that this can be put an end to, then you will actually aspire to put an end to it and reach nirvana. This understanding and insight should come on the basis of understanding emptiness. Extreme view. A belief in the supremacy of wrong views and belief in the supremacy of ethics and religious discipline. Page 299. And wrong view. Page 300. So within the wrong view, when you consider the karma and so forth not being actually real or truth or fact, then you actually have a denigration. Whereas when you view or that believes that the cause of living beings is the divine creator and primal essence, you have the exaggerating kind of wrong view. So I've explained these 10 afflictions in accordance with the compendium of knowledge and the levels of yogic deeds and with Vasubandhu's explanation of five aggregates. So here there is, of course, difference in subtlety between the afflictions that are recognized by the lower schools of Tinet and the Prasangikas. And next, the order in which the afflictions arise. One way to look at this is to consider ignorance as distinct from the view of the perishing aggregates. For example, when twilight falls on a coiled rope, its status as a rope will be unclear, and someone may imagine that it is a snake. Similarly, according to this view, the misapprehension of the aggregates as a self arises due to the darkness of ignorance, which prevents clarity about how the aggregates and aggregates. So, of course, oneself and others are different. And therefore, we have the practice of equating and equalizing, equating and exchanging self with others. But here, when we look at yourself and others, we have this view of a distinctly unrelated self and others. So true grasping at true existence and the self-cherishing attitudes are always working together to actually put us in difficult situation. So by understanding selflessness, you actually reduce the intensity and the strength of the self-grasping. And by cherishing others, you actually reduce this self-cherishing attitude. And so these two, grasping at self and self-cherishing attitude, actually are the causes of our all our problems. So within the self-cherishing, there could be those that which is not afflicted and those which are afflicted. So those that are not afflicted can be even in the arhats. And actually this does not actually cause harm to others, or the ruin to others. So page 301, the causes of afflictions. There are six folds. These are six folds as presented in the Bodhisattva levels. A basis object, social context, explanation, habituation, and attention. So basis refers to the latent proclivity of affliction for afflictions. An object refers to the appearance of objects conducive to the arising of an affliction. Social context refers to the influence of bad friends and foolish people. Explanation refers to listening to wrong teachings. Habituation refers to process of becoming accustomed to past afflictions. Attention refers to incorrect attention that projects pleasantness onto what has an unpleasant character, conceives an impermanent thing to be permanent, and the like. The four erroneous conceptions that mistakenly consider things that are actually impermanent, painful, impure, and lacking a self to be permanent, pleasant, pure, and possessed of a self. The faults of afflictions. When an affliction arises, at first it completely afflicts your mind, causing you to err with regard to what you are observing, reinforcing your latent proclivities, and causing the same sort of affliction to recur. It may harm you, others, or both. It leads to misdeeds in this life, in future lives, or in birth. It creates experiences of pain and anguish, as well as the suffering of birth and the like. It takes you far from nirvana. Your virtue is destroyed and your resources are depleted. In society, you feel apprehensive, joyless, and devoid of confidence, while your notoriety spreads in all directions. An excellent person such as teachers and protectors rebuke you. You die with regret. Your aims unfulfilled, and after death you are reborn into a miserable realm. Furthermore, as the ornament for the Mahayana Sutra says, you must have an understanding in accord with what Gompawa said. To avoid afflictions, you must know the afflictions' faults, their characteristics, their remedies, and the causes for their arising. After you have recognized these faults, regard them as defective and consider them enemies. If you do not recognize their faults at all times, check myself. Because the afflictions actually cause problems to oneself and others, and may I forcefully avert it, as the 8 verses of the Training the Mind says. So the afflictions must be combated by through the understanding of emptiness, and will not be cannot be overcome easily. So considering the suffering of the individual realms, the sufferings of the realms lower, three lower realms, the suffering of human beings, the god, the demigods, and the gods. The suffering of humans, page 113. This has already been explained, the suffering of lower realms, the suffering of humans. This consists in the suffering of hunger and thirst, unpleasant contact with heat and cold, frantic activity and fatigue. In addition, you should understand the seven types of suffering, birth, aging, illness, death, and so forth, by means of the previous explanations. Furthermore, in Discourse on the Collections, it says, all the suffering of lower realms also appear to exist for humans. Troubled by suffering, like many, like beings in hell, subjects of Yama, by their perversity. They also have the suffering of animals, powerful ones oppress the weak by force, inflicting harm on them. They are rivers, as it were. And 400 verse stanza says, higher ones have mental suffering, lower ones have physical pain. This world is overwhelmed by these two types of suffering every day. you should reflect on in accordance with these statements. In suffering of demigods, it is said that the demigods are mentally tormented by envy that cannot. So the suffering of gods, when their head cut off, head is cut off, then they die. Of course, this could be similar to us these days. Now, of course, we will die when we, our heads are chopped off. But when the limbs are chopped off, you can have new limbs, prosthetic limbs. The suffering of the gods, within the suffering of gods, there are the suffering of dying, transmigrating and falling, and the suffering of envy, suffering of being chopped up, split, killed and banished. And then the suffering of uppermost realms. And then next is how cyclic existence is entered. Our true origin, thinking about the stages of entering cyclic existence, how the mental afflictions arise, how karma is accumulated by the mental afflictions, how you die, transmigrate and take rebirth, how the mental afflictions arise. Although both karma and mental afflictions are necessary as causes to establish cyclic existence, the mental afflictions are chief. So, therefore, it is of great importance to rely on the antidotes to the mental afflictions, and that again depends on knowing the mental afflictions, which is why you should become skilled in them. Attachment observes an attractive, pleasant, and external actual identification of the mental afflictions has 10 points. So attachment, anger, pride, ignorance, doubt, the view of transitory collection or perishable aggregates, and view holding on extreme, and we holding a bad view to be best. The view holding a bad ethics and aesthetic practices to be best, wrong view, and wrong view. These are mental afflictions identified from the common perspective of higher and lower tenets. The Prasangika Madhyamaka systems will be explained below. So Master Tsongkhapa is making the point very clear here. The stages by which the mental afflictions arise, it has 3 points. The system of the treatises of levels assert that the view of transitory collections and ignorance are in opposition to each other. The system of the Madhyamakas and Madhyamakati assert that all the view of transitory collection itself is ignorance, and how the remaining root afflictions arise according to these two systems. So, the faults of mental afflictions. It is mentioned in the ornament of Mayana Sutra, the mental afflictions destroy you, destroy sentient beings, destroy your ethics. Once that is debased, you become inferior in gain, and guardians and teachers revile you, and so forth. And then engaging the bodhisattva conduct says, enemies such as hatred and craving do not have arms, legs, and so on. They have no valor either, so why is it that they have reduced me to servitude? While residing in my mind, they inflict harm on me, who am satisfied. The patience that does not get angry at them is unsuitable, blameworthy patience. Even if the gods and demigods were all to rise as enemies against me, they could not lead or put me into the fires of the incessant hell. The mental afflictions, these powerful foes, throw me in there within one moment where nothing met with, not even Mount Meru is left behind, or even ashes. So we'll move on to Lamrim Chamo. How the page number 303, how you thereby accumulate karma. And identifying karma that you accumulate and how you accumulate karma. And identifying the karma that you accumulate as karma that is intention and karma that is intended action. So Vaibhashikas divide physical and verbal karma into two types, the perceptible and the imperceptible, and hold that both types always have form. Vasubandhu refutes this, asserting that physical and verbal karma are intentions that work along with perceptible physical and verbal behavior. Thus, both forms of karma, intention and intended, are actually intentions. In general, karma is of three types, virtuous, non-virtuous, and ethically neutral. But here we are concerned only with the first two. Virtuous karma is of two types, contaminated and uncontaminated. I will only discuss contaminated virtuous karma, of which there are two types, that present in a noble being's mind and that present in an ordinary person's mind. Only the latter need concern us here. Non-virtuous karma is karma that is non-meritorious. Meritorious karma is virtuous karma in the minds of beings of the desire realm. Invariable karma is contaminated without karma in the minds of beings of the contaminated virtuous karma in the minds of beings of the form of formless realms. Similarly, the treasury of knowledge says, merit is the virtuous karma of the desire realm. Invariable karma produces the higher deities realms. Why is it called invariable karma? In the desire realm, karma that should bear fruit while you are a deity may instead bear fruit while you are a human, an animal, or a hungry ghost. Thus, its effect is variable. In the higher realms, higher deities realms, karma that should bear fruit at a certain level does not mature at levels other than that. Thus, it is invariable. Thus, the treasury of knowledge says, why? Because the fusion of karma on these levels is not variable. How you accumulate karma? In general, noble beings create and accumulate only virtuous karma. Yet, stream enterers and once returners, noble beings on lower levels, they accumulate not virtuous karma. However, such noble beings do not accumulate karma that would impel them into the cyclic existence of either happy or miserable realms. For, as Nagarjuna's fundamental treatise on the middle way says, so if you create a karma to reach, to attain nirvana, there's the calm, considering someone who has seen the faults of all worldly concerns, and moreover, consider the virtuous karma that is wisdom, consciousness, accurately analyzing the meaning of self. And is this a true origin, a cause of cyclic existence? In general, page 305. However, In reply, it says, in general, those who are on the path of accumulation and preparation or do accumulate ordinary karma that impels rebirth, however, motivations based on thoughts such as those you describe, as well as virtuous karma, similar to the wisdom that analyzes self as constitute a group, the group of remedies for the craving for future existence. Further, in both their objective and subjective aspects, they operate in a manner contrary to the conception of self, the root of cyclic existence. Thus, they are not actual or usual true origins that impel rebirth. However, because they approximate actual true origins leading to the future rebirth, they are included among true origins. So it says, this being the case, you might not have acquired the last paragraph through extensive meditative analysis of the faults of cyclic existence, the remedy that eradicates this craving for the wonders of cyclic existence. Also, you might not have used discerning wisdom to properly analyze the meaning of selflessness and might not have become familiar with the two spirits of enlightenment, conventional and ultimate. Under such circumstances, your virtuous activities, with some exceptions on account of the field's power, would constitute typical origins of suffering and hence would fuel the process of cyclic existence. How you accumulate karma is explained in two parts, accumulating karma for pleasant feelings, accumulating karma for neutral feelings. Within the first one, there's accumulating karma for the pleasures that come from enjoying desirable objects, sights, sounds, and the like. This has two subtypes. If your concern is mainly for pleasures of this lifetime prior to death, then you accumulate non-meritorious action. If your concern is primarily for the essential pleasures of future lives, you accumulate meritorious karma actions. And accumulating karma for gaining bliss in meditative concentration. After you have rejected attachment or external sensual pleasures, and B, accumulating karma for neutral feelings, you might have stopped attachment to sensual pleasure, become weary even of meditative bliss, and created karma to have neutral feelings. If so, you will accumulate invariable karma leading to rebirth in the fourth meditative civilization of the form realm or in higher level, up to and including the peak of cyclic existence, the highest level of the formless realm. This schema of subdivisions is what Vasubandhu intended to convey in this treasury of knowledge. By his reasoning, when you stop clinging to all of cyclic existence and then engage in physical, verbal, and mental virtue for the sake of liberation, you leave cyclic existence further behind and come closer to liberation. Next, how you die and are reborn. This is explained in five parts. Causes of death, the mind at death, where heat gathers, how you reach the intermediate state after death, how you then take rebirth. Regarding the first, death from the exhaustion of your lifespan means dying after you have used up all of the lifespan that was projected by your previous karma. As the time has come, you die. Death from exhaustion of your merit means, for example, dying deprived of the necessities of life. There is also death from failure to avoid danger, in regard to which the sutras list 9 causes and conditions for premature death. Overeating, eating something indigestible, eating without having digested the previous meal, failing to expel undigested food that has accumulated in the stomach, intestinal obstruction, not relying on specific medicines for specific illnesses, failing to understand the distinction between accustomed and unaccustomed activities, untimely death, as accidental death, and engaging in sexual intercourse. The mind at death, dying with a virtuous mind. Those who die with a virtuous mind, whether through remembering on their own or through being reminded by others, turn their minds to virtue such as faith for as long as coarse discrimination. Ordinary types of consciousness remains. In the case of death, for those who have cultivated either virtue or non-virtue unequally, they either remember on their own or are reminded by others what they have become accustomed to do repeatedly in the past, and this becomes extremely powerful. Their minds then become absorbed in this and forget all else. if they are equally familiar with both virtue and non-virtue, then they cannot stop remembering what they remember first and cannot engage their minds in anything else. Those who have cultivated virtue seem to pass from darkness into light. As they die, various pleasant and attractive images appear as though in dream. They die comfortably, and at the point of death, intense feelings of suffering do not arise in their bodies. For those who are currently doing what is right, the final agony of death is minimal, dying with a non-virtuous mind. So according to Vasubandhusarabhidharma's Kosha, when someone has a very active coarse discrimination, or then they can actually remember their past virtuous practices. And according to the highest yoga tantra, through one's yoga, power of one's meditation, then and the yogi can actually turn the subtle mind into the very subtle mind into a virtuous state of mind. So it's all this is making this where heat gathers. So just above that, he was commenting on Vasubandhu's treasury of auto-commentary. Among those who are currently cultivating non-virtue, consciousness leaves the body coming down from the upper parts, which become a cold first. When it reaches the heart, it leaves the body. The consciousness of someone who is currently cultivating virtue leaves coming up from the lower part of the body and lower part, and the body becomes cold from the lower part. This is asking the time. In both cases, consciousness leaves from the heart. The point at which consciousness first enters the fertilized ovum becomes the body's heart. Consciousness finally leaves the body from where it first entered. Given that, at first, the heat of the body either descends from the upper parts or gathers in the heart, or ascends from the lower parts and gathers in the heart. After that, though Vasubandhu and Asanga do not say so, you should understand that in both cases, the remaining heat in the body gathers into the heart from the other end of the body. How you reach the intermediate state after death, as the consciousness leaves leaves from that spot, as just explained, you die and reach the intermediate state immediately. Just as one arm of a balancing scale tips up when the other arm tips down. As to its causes, the intermediate state is contingent upon having become attached to your body and being filled with the delight in your previous worldly activities and karma, whether virtuous or non-virtuous. Furthermore, the being of the intermediate state possesses a complete set of sensory faculties. So until it takes rebirth, its vision is unimpeded like divine vision, and its body as well as unimpeded as though it had miraculous powers. So when someone dies, we can do prayers and pujas for them, but mainly, as it is said, one's karma increases and one will not meet with the effect of a karma which one has not created. But Geshe Potowa says, because of blood relations or because of connection relation in terms of one's wealth and in relation through dharma, so when children do some prayers for their dead parents, because of their karmic relationship, a blood relationship, It actually is said to have an effect on the deceased parents. And then if you actually have the same wealth in one household, then if someone from your group dies and you do pujas for them, that also is helpful to them, to the deceased. And then when a disciple, because of his or her dharma connection with his or her teacher, when the teacher has passed away, if the students do pujas and prayers for them, then that also is helpful. And so we can actually create these kind of causes for happiness for the deceased in this way. And so, and as we say, the Lama is greater for us, greater than all the Buddhas, and particularly the greater than Master Buddha Shakyamuni. And so there is some connection there. It misperceives its father's semen, its blood, mother's blood, as its parents lying together. Its parents are not actually lying together at that time, yet as if in an illusion it seems, it sees them lying together and becomes attached. If it is reborn to be female, it turns away from the 312. From the women and desires the man, wanting to lie with him. If it is to be born male, it turns away from the man and desires the women, wanting to lie with her. In this way, as the levels of yogic deeds explains, it does not see its actual parents. It sees them lying together through misperceiving the semen and the blood. Having conceived such a desire, the being of the intermediate state draws closer and closer to the man and woman, eventually arriving at a point where it cannot see any part of their bodies except for their genitals. Angry at that sight, it dies and is reborn. Moreover, the mother and the father generate desire, which becomes intense for a period at the end of which a gelatinous semen is emitted. Then drops of semen and blood invariably issue forth from the two of them, mixing within the mother's reproductive tract, then congealing like the skin on the top of the boiled milk that has been allowed to cool. At this point, the intermediate state of the being who is to be reborn ends, and this being's fundamental consciousness enters the congealed mass. The force of this consciousness brings together a developed combination of blood and semen that is conducive to producing the sensory faculties, as well as a mixture of the former congealed blood and semen and subtle traces of four great elements that are the causes of the sensory faculties. So the week or the 7 day here refers to the human week, or it is also sometimes interpreted as the week in the next rebirth, wherever the being is going to be reborn.
So in today's research, it is quite doubtful whether it actually happens like this. As it's on page 312, then the drops of semen inevitably issue forth and the mixing within the reproductive tract, then congealing like the skin on the top of the boiled milk that has been allowed. So this is quite questionable. So these days we have scientifically reproducing in humans by taking the semen and the blood or the ovum into some test tube in experiment laboratories, and actually humans grow and the embryo starts without having the process having to go happen in the womb. So with regard to the elements, the commentary to Brahmana Samuchaya by Gesta Dharma Rinchen says, the elements to be very, very subtle as well. The usual explanation of elements, the definition of elements, may be at a very gross or coarse state. So in the fire and wind element, the earth, fire, wind elements are they are not distinct. So in Ratnavali, Nagarjuna actually says, when the elements themselves are not there, and how can there be a form, a perceptible form? So it seems to be, so because of that, he says the physical things are merely name. And so since these physical things arise or come from elements, and elements, as said earlier, cannot be really found, which refers to a very subtle one. And he says, form is merely a name, and therefore the space, unobstructing space, is also name. So there is nothing that we can actually point to as being the space objectively, and therefore he says, therefore the mere name itself is also nominal. So because there is no there's no element, there are no elements, therefore how can we see the forms and so forth. So these are very using subtle, very powerful reasoning to destroy objectification of things. And then when you think about the selflessness, a self is neither the aggregates nor different from the aggregates and so forth, and you say, this, what am I? If this is case, then what am I? I am, and then you you can use this verse from the Nagarjuna's root verses of the Middle Way, from the 22nd chapter, for you to and apply it to yourself, and then, of course, we have to give thought to them,
and then also about the continuity of things. And then when, even in the Prasangika Madhyamaka tradition, there is this thing called shikpa, or the having seized nature of things. And so on the basis of which they explain how we actually, how the karmas are that are created leave some imprint, and although many lifetimes go by, still one's karma, those that karma can give rise to its effect, and so it's unlike the things. The disintegration or this having ceased, posited by the lower schools of tenets within Buddhism as being something permanent, or the Prasangika say it's a functional thing. But then, even in this case, and of course, it's merely name. And so, Bhava Viveka says that in his school, according to his philosophical view, the consciousness of a person is the identity of the person. So because he asserts that things should have or must have some objective existence, and this must be something substantial, and because of that, the instance of a person is actually said to regarded as the consciousness is regarded as an instance of a person. And Jerembuche has said is so although it may be very difficult for you who have studied Madhyamaka to say that things are merely mere name, and conventionally designated and in merely name, may be difficult for you to assert, but this is the one that you should actually hold on to. It is better to actually assert that. Page 313, the Treasury of Knowledge says, at the end of the page, in his commentary on this, Visabandhu explains that if the being of the intermediate state is to be reborn from heat and moisture, it craves smells, while if it is to be reborn spontaneously, it desires a place and is subsequently reborn there. And you follow the levels of yogic deeds in explaining how you die and are reborn in unexceptional cases. So stop here. Metotam Sanje Shindo Mikte Puayi Indrukunum Dashi. and